Hello and welcome back to the Would You Give Me a Stagehand podcast. My name is Toby Patan and let's jump right into this week's episode. Today I speak with cinematographer and photographer Gyani Pradhan Wong Aswi about their upcoming thesis film, Moving Room. We talk about how they first developed an interest in film, spending their adolescence living with host families, and how those experiences led to this phenomenal project. Gyani has become a great friend and an amazing collaborator of mine, and so I'm very excited to share this conversation with you all. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Gyani Pradhan Wong Aswi, and I'm a filmmaker and photographer, artist. I'm about to graduate from Clark University with a BA in Screen Studies. The question of where I'm from is a complicated one. It's always a story that I have to sort of get into when somebody asks me that. But this is what we're doing here. Is like, I'm here to tell you that story.
Right.
So my mom is from Sikkim, which is in the northeastern part of India, and it used to be its own independent kingdom before it was annexed by India in the 1970s. And that's where I lived until I was 15. And before that, I lived in Mauritius, which is where my dad is from. And Mauritius is a tiny little island in the middle of the Indian Ocean off the coast of Madagascar. And to give you a sense of how tiny it is, it's like, I don't think it's even a third the size of Rhode Island or something. It's really, really small. Yeah. And it was colonized by both the British and the French. And then I've been living in Massachusetts for the last 7 years. I feel like that's become a significant part of where I would say I'm from as well now.
Right.
So yeah, three different places.
So different.
Right? So yeah, and I would say that I'm from all of those places, yeah, as well as saying that I'm also not from any of those places at the same time. It's both.
It's, yeah.
And in between.
Right, it's everywhere. Everything everywhere all at once. All right. And then, so I wanted to like hear about how you got into film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this, I didn't really start like film. I started out as wanting to be a novelist in middle school. I remember really being obsessed with like young adult novels. Specifically, I got into the Heroes of Olympus series, Percy Jackson, The Hunger Games, Divergent.
You said that your dad would read the book to you. I thought that was so sweet.
Yeah, yeah. So how I got started with that was, I remember I got the first book in the Heroes of Olympus series, The Lost Hero, for maybe it was my, I don't remember what age I was, like 6th or 5th grade. And I remember being really intimidated by the size, like the thickness of the book, and I was like, no, I'm not touching that. And then my dad was just like, okay, what if we like read this before bed every night? I was like, okay, like we'll give it a shot. And cut to like 3 days into him having read like a chapter every night, I was like, I picked up the book and started reading it myself and like got through it in under a week. Maybe it was like, I just like was off to the races with it, and I became obsessed with storytelling. I was really, really hooked. And that's kind of what set me on that journey. I think I've always sort of responded to things that I've been interested in with trying to do it myself. And so the natural sort of reaction for me to sort of responding really well to young adult novels was to want to write one myself. And for a while, that's something that I knew I wanted to do. And I started to write my own novel, and that like was a really unique, interesting experience. But as I started to do it more and more, write a lot, I started to realize that I wanted to see the stories that I was telling take a different form, essentially. Mm. And that's when the sort of notion of film came into the picture. So it wasn't like I watched one film
right.
and then I was like, this is the like this is what I want to do now, is I want to be a filmmaker.
So interesting. Okay.
Which is yeah, it's
yeah, I had my very first interview, she was my friend from film camp. She said that Princess Mononoke that made it her. But it's so interesting to hear that you kind of had like a different
No, it wasn't one film. Right. It was the idea of filmmaking, and not even like film as a medium, but like the process behind it that really got me interested in the first place. I was really intrigued by the fact that film incorporated various different art forms into one medium, and that they all kind of like came together to create something that was like bigger than the sum of its parts. And I think I was like obviously interested in storytelling. It was also a storytelling medium. But then that it involved all these other disciplines, because I was also had some tangential interest in music,
photography.
So like, and that's how that kicked off. Was like, I begged my parents for a camera, and lo and behold, on my, I don't even remember how old I was. It was like 2016. I think I was 14, I guess. So I got a camera for my birthday, and
I
was so
fucking
happy.
Do you remember what
kind of camera it was? Yeah, it was a Nikon D5200 or something. It's like an entry level DSLR.
Okay, cool, dope. I had a Rebel T6i.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
working
basically,
at a bakery when I was like 16. 17.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. So it's like, yeah, I think a lot of people got their start on one of those kinds of cameras, and it taught me a lot. I think just being able to have the camera and go out there and start looking at the world through the viewfinder. And I've been using a camera ever since. But yeah, that's sort of how I got into film.
So dope, so dope.
Actually, I can add to that little bit.
Yeah, go for it.
But this is like not, well, because it happened in stages is the thing.
Right.
Like I would say that's like the genesis of it. It's okay. Like, okay, transitioning from like novels to film and then having a camera to be able to photograph and make films, but it wasn't until like COVID that I really started watching movies, like and that's when I became obsessed with Letterboxd.
Okay.
And I would watch
Letterboxd guy. I can't.
No, that's fine. Yeah. It's just I think it tickled like this part of my brain for wanting to like categorize, catalog, and really like keep track of everything that I was watching.
Right.
It made it this like nice, neat, and easy way to be able to keep track of that, and that really satisfied me.
Yeah.
And also, I think in some ways, like creating a map for like getting into film, you know?
Right. Because even with like the sites like Letterboxd, I use IMDb, but like I just have like watch lists, like things I want to watch, things I have watched, like even within that, things you have watched, like okay, you like I recently watched Todo Sobre Mi Madre, and then like a recommended film was Mommy, Xavier and so I'm watching that now. It's like I feel like sites like that, they just like it takes you down a maze of like keep staying in more films.
No, it is, it's like a pathway, right?
Exactly.
And this is, it happened gradually, obviously, but I remember I had seen a bunch of Nolan, knew that I liked Nolan, had my film bro era, I guess you could say, gotten to like watch Pulp Fiction with my host father.
Coen Brothers, probably.
Yeah, like, Coen Brothers, yeah. You know, just like going down that pathway, but then seeing what I liked, what I didn't like, eventually graduating, I don't know if you can say graduating, but getting more into Wes Anderson. And that was like the pipeline to so many other filmmakers who were less known.
Right.
And yeah, I feel like that's how I was able to kind of track my taste and what I liked and what I didn't like. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started to really be influenced by the films I was watching. 'Cause that's not something I was thinking about as much before. The kinds of films that I was making prior to that were very much along the lines of, I would say, like YouTube videos as opposed to films.
Right.
They were very often like travel videos or like sports videos, and often documentary. So like taking like trips that I took with my family and then cutting that together to music. So it was not really narrative in that sense. And during COVID is really when that took shape for me. I made my first, I feel like that, yeah, I would consider that to be my first short film. We made, me and my friends from high school made this short film called You're in Hell. And it's like a double entendre for you are in hell, but also urine, like peeing.
Okay.
It's about this guy who basically like is, really has to pee, and he can't find a bathroom during COVID. And it was based on like a real experience that I had.
That premise. Yeah, and I love that title.
And it was like the idea was to like push this character to the brink of like existentialism because of the fact that he has to pee so bad.
Such a meaty but simple premise with like such opportunity for like amazing storytelling.
Yeah, and it literally came up from an experience that I actually had during COVID, because like every restaurant closed their bathroom. You weren't allowed to use bathrooms anywhere.
Send me. Is it on
YouTube? It's on YouTube. Channel? Yeah.
Okay. Well, I need to follow, subscribe to YouTube, and then also follow you on Letterboxd. I'll try it early. So, going into Moving Room and how that came to be, your thesis film that you wrote, directed, edited, producer. Got to get those credits in. Yeah, talk to me about that. I'm sure you're going to hit on all the same points that you did, and I'll jump in when I want to elaborate.
What exactly do you want me to hit on?
So, how it came to be?
Yeah.
How it came to be, what mindset you were in while writing it, / what mindset you were drawing from in your life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, what was at the core of the idea really was to draw on my experiences in high school. Specifically making the move from Sikkim to the U.S., specifically Beverly, Massachusetts, white suburban town, and living with different, like, host families, because the school that I went to, Waring, was a day school, wasn't a boarding school. So I ended up living with a number of different host families, and that sort of served as the main inspiration. Specifically, there was this one sort of theme that I knew I wanted to turn into a film at some point, and I just had in like my notes app, specifically being gravitated towards like the idea of the car as an instrument of agency in suburbia, from the immigrant perspective, right? Where it's like, as my friends were starting to get their driver's licenses at the age of 16, or like permits slowly, and then graduating into them having cars that they can like get around in. So that kind of birthed the idea of what was initially titled Backseat, to kind of reflect the idea.
How are you so good at coming up with titles? I struggle with it so much. Okay. Keep going.
But yeah, so Backseat was essentially this road movie, and this is what I proposed in my like thesis proposal.
Okay.
Moving Room is a very different film than Backseat. Moving Room, basically, I would say, took a different sort of shape on the exterior, but interior is very, very much the same. It has the same DNA as Backseat. Where Backseat was this like road trip movie, I just found that was just not going to be logistically possible to film in the winter. And the alternative to kind of shooting it on location in a real car would have been to use something like rear projection in a studio. And we did have the opportunity to film the studio because they just built the new building, MacD. The only problem was I couldn't put a car down in that basement.
Because you knew somebody who worked at a junkyard who was like, I got you.
Yeah. And that just didn't seem feasible to me. Yeah. And that's when the idea to kind of work with that came about, and Moving Room was born. Moving Room is essentially the marriage between this thread, the idea of the car as an instrument of agency, coupled with the domestic space, specifically in relation to host families, and the idea of home coming together. Mm. So when those two ideas sort of merged, that gave birth to the idea of the house that's moving. So that also reflects sort of the instability of my relationship with home, and not sort of having it be a stable and fixed thing, which has been sort of a theme throughout my life, right. Trying to understand where I belong. And so that's how the idea of Moving Room kind of came to be. Mm-hmm. And the writing process was quite interesting. I would say it was honestly a struggle at first. I think one of my biggest takeaways was stop trying to write, or stop trying to edit while I'm writing. That's definitely something that I had.
So hard to do or not do.
Yeah. I think it's what often prevents people from actually writing, and it was the same in my case. Also, adhering to the sort of screenplay format was something that really was stunting the way I was writing. In my head, I sort of thought that I had to abide by these very specific screenwriting conventions. Mm-hmm. In formatting the writing, not kind of putting any direction or cinematography into the screenplay.
Which is, but I'm where such a, your brain is oriented, yeah, in cinematography.
No, my brain really goes there. I'm such a visual person, and it's perfect that I work in film, you know. And I found myself wanting to put that in at every turn. And that's when watching Eraserhead came into the picture. The first time I watched Eraserhead was during COVID. I think I just didn't really have the context for understanding the film back then. But on this watch, I really resonated with a lot of what Lynch was trying to do, specifically the more sort of surreal, more experimental techniques that he was using, despite the fact that there was a sort of plot... Right. To sort of center the sort of surreal elements. And that's exactly what I wanted to do with Moving Room, was to really have a plot that sort of guides the audience, but then employ experimental techniques to be able to get those ideas across. Mm-hmm. And watching Eraserhead sort of inspired me to be less apologetic, less like I was trying to appease the audience, mm-hmm. And sort of having confidence that the audience would understand what it is that I was trying to do.
Right.
And I also read the screenplay for Eraserhead,
okay.
Which really was even more freeing. Eraserhead is a 90-minute movie. The screenplay is about 30 pages long.
That man, David Lynch.
The screenplay for Moving Room is 9 minutes or 9 pages long. And the film right now is around 18 minutes long. And so that really gives you a sense of, like, I don't know what I said last time too, is like the screenplay is a blueprint. It's not the sort of framework that you need to follow to the T. And I think that's what really was paralyzing for me, is that once I kind of stopped trying to write a Hollywood screenplay and really embraced the fact that I was doing something, that the story wanted to be something that pushed those boundaries, and I was no longer adhering to those conventions, mm-hmm. It opened the whole world for me.
So something you talked about that was a huge part of Moving Room, which resonates with me a lot, is like the idea of America being built for cars, and kind of the dichotomy between suburbia and like metropolitan urban area. So I wanted to know, like, you could talk a little bit about that, and like, why was that like important for you to depict in this film specifically? It's like some things you said, you were like, you found independence in cities, you were like, but then the car is also like as a vehicle of like contraptment, and like you said, like you had no control because you were in the passenger seat and your friends were in the driver's seat.
So I mean, it all comes directly from lived experience, I think, is the key sort of point. My literal experience and perception of the world was mediated by a car very often. Just even in having to go to the grocery store or visit a friend, it's always, oh, we get in the car and we go there. And I think it really was that sort of sense that I was not finding that when I did visit cities. I would visit Boston or New York City every so often, and what I would find is that I was just like had a radically different sense of perception because of the way that I was traversing or navigating the space. And
say more about that. Like, did it make you think about your own like subjectivity or like?
I mean, for sure, and like that's what like cities meant freedom. It was the equivalent of that to me at the time, especially as a teenager, in a brand new place, trying to sort of figure my way around. Mm-hmm. I just had more control and agency, really is like the key word there, that I had license over my agency in a city, whereas when I went back to the suburbs, it was always asking someone for a ride, asking a friend for a ride, asking my host parent for a ride to different places. Mm-hmm. And that was just, like the byproduct of the way that like the roads are built. Like cars are the main mode of transportation in the United States.
Right.
Like highways are built for cars. Mm-hmm. And public transportation is often neglected to such a heavy degree. Except maybe in metropolitan areas. Right. But even then,
it's still bad. It's so bad.
You compare it to other countries. Exactly. Yeah. So this was definitely the most extensive pre-production process I'd ever gone through. I mean, overall, this film was just the biggest project that I've taken on to date.
You did such a good job of like keeping your head on your shoulders, like, and I give props to you because that's so hard. You were so like grounded, like you like came off so like poised, like professional. Like I felt good coming to set every day and excited. So I mean, like, that's hard to do on your first like set, like control. Like directing your peers, good job. But like, how did you like stay patient, stay grounded, like adapt to people's communication styles, etc.?
I mean, honestly, if I were to say there was a secret, I don't know. The one sort of element that I embrace more than anything else is working with a team. Like, I feel like it's so sort of surface level to say like, oh, I practice all these different things and that's how that worked out. It's like, it wasn't just me. Mm-hmm. I really did have a team of people that I really, really believed in and who I was working with for specific reasons.
Right.
And that I had built these connections over time too. This was not our first film together. Specifically, Nicole Overbaugh, who I've collaborated with on a number of films at this point. I think we've Long Play, Ask the Birds, The Bread Knife, Moving Room.
Wow.
Four films where I've directed and they've sort of been like assistant director or producer in some capacity, and films that they've directed where I've been cinematographer.
Right.
So that's a relationship that really carries forward. It builds right. upon one another. And I just think that, like, I would not have been able to get anywhere near where I was trying to go.
Mm-hmm.
Because while it was the sort of biggest project that I'd taken on to date, I had all these people who really believed in the story, who believed in me, and who I believed in. So it goes both ways in that sense, that I just did not do this by myself. Pre-production was really about working with these people to schedule, to plan, to write, conceptualize,
camera testing,
which I had never done before. Working with JT, that elevated the production, specifically in the image making sort of realm.
Yeah.
I was able to sort of bring stuff to life that I like never would have been able to without JT. With his technical knowledge, but also conceptual knowledge and his interpretation of my screenplay, and being able to have those conversations with him about how he was interpreting the
right.
the material.
Yeah, shout out DPJT on Instagram. Amazing filmmaker based in the Boston area. But yeah, I remember you said that you were originally thinking of bringing on Congo. Is that the
Kunga? Yeah,
Kunga.
Yeah.
Sorry. Just not that. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, talk about your progression from
sure.
that.
I mean,
choice.
Well, that's the thing too. Is like I knew that this project was going to be the biggest project to date, so I really wanted to make sure that I was collaborating with the right people. Specifically, I met Kunga on Instagram. I'm not sure exactly. I remember how specifically, but Kunga is a New York City-based filmmaker. Originally from India, specifically from, I think, from Tibet. That is what kind of guided my reasoning for wanting him to DP. He had that immediate connection of having experienced immigration, specifically from India to the US,
right.
and specifically that Himalayan perspective. Which is what was true for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted that to be reflected there. And again, logistics get in the way. We thought we would be able to bring him down from New York City. And I did have, thankfully, the budget to be able to support that.
Right.
He potentially was going to bring in a gaffer as well.
Mm.
And that just didn't end up working out. We would have had only 3 days to shoot the specific yeah. sequence. And that's when I sort of started brainstorming other people who might DP on the project. And I don't know, I really wasn't expecting JT to say yes. I had worked with him as a second AC
right.
on a set, an Emerson set, that I was only called on because they were short on hands.
Okay. Yeah, and I just like randomly,
which
Abby
is crazy,
told me about that.
Yeah. So it's like these little things, and that's one of the only like sort of non-Clark set experiences I've had.
Same.
Which is wild, because like literally from one experience doing that, JT became the cinematographer for the film that I directed, which is
yeah.
just wild. So I'm extremely grateful to have met JT in that capacity, and to sort of, you know, continue to collaborate, because it was just such a amazing process to be able to work with someone like JT, who really understood what I was trying to do, but then not just understand that, but like take it and use his interpretation of it to elevate the story through the image.
Mm. As a cinematographer, director, photographer, what are you looking for when you're seeking that out for your own project? Like, what types of things take priority? What types of things are you willing to learn from them? Like, what types of things do you want them to offer to the project that you may not offer? So on and so forth.
Specifically, me as a director looking for a cinematographer? Or
no, you as a fellow cinematographer looking for another cinematographer. because you have that perspective of like, oh, if I was to do this on someone's project, this is, I would do X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
But yeah. What are you looking for your own work? Or would you in the future want to DP your own stuff like Alfonso Cuarón, which is someone else you admire?
Yeah. I mean, that's a super interesting question, actually. Because I do, yeah. I mean, they're very different hats to wear as a director and a director of photography. I think the reason I gravitate towards DPing is because it's a much smaller subsect of the filmmaking process that allows me to kind of focus uniquely on the creative visual elements of the film without sort of having to handle the pressure of the entire production. Mm. Directing is extremely taxing. It's you're really steering the ship and making sure that everything is always accounted for, because you're basically like the liaison between all these different departments, and you're making sure that they're all kind of on track, mm-hmm. and you're the one responsible for that communication flow.
Right.
And yeah, I guess to reflect on past opportunities where I've had a cinematographer on a project, this is the first time where I've actually like intentionally reached out to a cinematographer to DP my film.
Right.
And I would say, specifically in this case, I really wanted someone who had a greater technical knowledge of the medium than I did. And that's where sort of specialization comes into play. JT is a director of photography by trade. Like, that's his thing. And I had seen some of his work before, like obviously worked with him. So that gave me a sense, obviously, that I knew what kind of, what he was capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that I knew for a fact that he knew a lot more than I did in terms of cinematography. I have like 3 credits to my name as a director of photography. And so I really was looking for someone who had not only the technical but also the personal experience to right. back it up as well. That was extremely important to me, not only with the role of director of photography but every role on this film. And pretty much every set that I sort of want to direct on in the future. I think it's really important to me to have diversity in terms of identity and perspective, because of perspective. And that for the people who are making the film to be able to resonate with what the film is about.
Right.
Specifically in this case, immigration, it was really important for me to have people of color mm-hmm. on the set, especially in roles that really are the sort of creative, sort of, I don't know how to say this, like in roles that are the sort of creative, like heads,
right.
and the director of photography is one of those roles
exactly.
because they're responsible for creating the visual language of the film. Yeah, so that's kind of how I went about choosing who I wanted, and in the first place it was guided by sort of like my approaching Kunga was because he would have been able to relate to what the film was about
mm-hmm.
in that way.
Right. Yeah, okay. So I wanted to revisit a conversation I remember having with you maybe like the second day on set.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was just kind of like blown away by like the grace that which you were telling this like very complex, deep, emotional story. And I was like, hey, so how are you doing that? Like, I'm like, I want to be able to do that too in my writing. It's like, you write what you know, a lot of writing, you're kind of low-key just processing your own trauma or processing
that's what it's all about
from your childhood.
Honestly.
So I was like, okay, how do you do that with, how do you do that without, you know, like, overwhelming yourself, overwhelming the story, clouding the story with, like, there's so many things you want to depict, but like you were saying, like, what you think, what you envision in your head for any given film is not what's going to be depicted on screen. And I remember you saying you start with one large idea concept and then either pull from it, expand upon that. Can you just like revisit that idea? Because I want to know more about that.
Well, for one, I'm a firm believer that a screenplay is the blueprint. And blueprints aren't exactly what ends up being made. And I really want to make that distinction because I feel like that's something that I struggled with as a younger filmmaker, was being married to the idea of
the film. It's so funny that you say younger filmmaker, like where you are right now. It just like goes to show how like prolific like you are and like how serious you are. But, yeah, I know what you mean.
But just like when I was starting out, exactly, you know, I really used to make that mistake from an emotional point of view. I feel like it's just like I would sort of get attached to the idea of what the film was in my head, and I had a very specific vision for what it was going to look like. And my expectation was that whatever was up here in my head was then like going to transfer on the screen. But it's like the movie in your head is never the movie you're going to make. And that goes to show that like it's all about the process and embracing the process. Let the process guide you, because the process is speaking to you, and it's speaking to you about what your story wants to be, what your film wants to be, because the film in your head is never going to be the film that's on the screen. First and foremost, because of budget reasons, and because what's in your head is your imagination and not reality. Like those are two very different things. And so I think I got to that, attached to that expectation when I was just starting out. And what I have sort of learned and had to learn was how to learn to focus on the process and like trust in that. And I'm such a happier filmmaker for it. Embracing those happy accidents, mm-hmm. and logistical quirks that kind of show you this is what the story wanted to be all along,
right?
You know, because that's what's also shaping the story. That's reality right there.
Yeah. It's such an interesting way to frame it, and like, yeah, I don't know, it's just I feel like you're constantly like peeling back so many layers like of filmmaking. Like I think I would say like most people like watching movies, right? But not a lot of people like have the relationship that like you or like anyone else we know who makes films like have with it, which is why I think it's like so important to like follow the calling or whatever. And maybe like do art you're passionate about, but like you have these like real perspectives and thoughts and like emotions towards film that like it would be like a disservice to yourself to not like follow those impulses and that like artistic creativity, which is why I'm like I feel the same way, like, and I feel like I'm, like, even the conversations I've had with you in terms of, like, screenplay and, like, writing and production, like, I feel like I'm learning so much, like, more than I ever learned in, like, any classroom. So it's just, like, you learn by doing, which
for sure.
It's so hard. It's so hard to do that with grace and, like, we're so young and, like, you're even younger than I am. It's, like, that's why I'm, like, so continue to be so impressed by your work. All right, what else do I want to touch on? So yeah, and saying like the screenplay is not a recipe, some other things you brought up were staying true to the core idea of your film. How you do it doesn't matter as long as you follow
what if you go back to what my film was originally supposed to be, like, what's the point between Backseat and how Backseat became Moving Room is like a perfect example, I would say, of how to hold on to the core of your idea. The truth in that story idea that you have, as long as you're holding on to that, I think it really doesn't matter the delivery method through which that happens. Like, because on the surface the story might be changing, and that obviously impacts how people are experiencing the story, but as long as you're sort of guided by that central idea, I think you'll be fine no matter what you end up making. For one, I want to go back to what I'm realizing about my work, which is that it's never not going to come from a personal place for me, I think. I think I'm, as a person, not even as a filmmaker, I think that I'm a very introspective person. I feel like I reflect a lot. And in some ways, film is about therapy. For me,
yes.
It's about like what we were talking about earlier, processing the trauma that I went through, specifically in the case of Moving Room, with the trauma that I experienced in high school. While I wasn't aware of those traumas at the time that they were happening, from a more sort of matured perspective in college, and that separation, having that distance is what allowed me to kind of look back and sort of deconstruct what exactly I was going through. Also with the new sort of knowledge that I had gained in college.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, my work in photography kind of follows the same idea. I'm working on this book at the moment titled Meditations on Coming Home.
Okay.
Which I got a grant for last summer to basically use use photography as a means of meditation to reflect on having returned home.
Okay. Is this going to be like a photography book?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's so sick.
And specifically, I shot analog film because it's, first of all, the medium that I'm most comfortable with. I've been shooting film photography since my junior year of high school.
Wow.
And I truly believe that it's an image-making process that is very conducive to meditation because it asks of one to be mindful and in the present about what you're photographing. And I really wanted to embrace that process to sort of look without any preconceived notions at the world around me, to not sort of look at, say I was like walking around this room with my camera, to sort of look at this table and not call it a table, but to look at it as light bouncing off of an object and hitting my retina in very specific way. It's just light and shape at the end of the day.
Wow.
To really abstract the physical world around us. Even the most mundane things, I feel like, become special in that way. And that's how I was sort of revisiting home, was through that lens. And film photography is even more conducive to that because you don't get to see what you just shot. Like, you have no way of knowing. It's like you hit that shutter button and you move on. Like, there's not, yeah.
And it even like kind of further emphasizes the idea of happy accidents because of how many happy accidents come from film photography.
Yeah. Well, again, it teaches you that lesson of like, it's all about the process, right? The sort of physical demands of film photography are so much greater than digital photography. You have to go through this whole process that's a labor of love.
Mm-hmm.
If you're like developing your own photos,
I wonder,
not only learning how to use the physical mechanisms on the camera and then scanning them or enlarging your photos.
Right. Literally, just what I was gonna ask you.
Yeah, it's all about the process.
And that's such like a, you don't do that stuff because you're bored. You do that because you love it. It's like, it's tricky. I remember just like while I was a student here, I would see you like in the photography lab so often, and like that work is hard. Like, And I'm not good at film photography. Like, I couldn't hack it. Like, my photos would never come out right how I wanted them to. Like, when I was developing them, I ran into so many issues. It's just, like, I don't think I have that patience, which is why I admire people who do and who can execute it so well. I'm, like, I'm always, like, there's no way. Like, there's no way. Like, it's too, like, when I look at your work, I'm, like, like, I obviously believe you, but I'm, like, it's just, like, so... Like, it's just amazing. It's just so well done, and it's...
Thank you, Toby.
I love just looking at it, like, it's great. I mean, I think that if I'm really going to challenge myself, something that I would revisit is film photography, you know? I'm getting kind of bored with digital photography. I'm getting, like, you know, for better or for worse, I'm like... And that's kind of, like, a micro interest of mine is... Super 8, like Super 8 recording, and I want to go back to that. Like, I just haven't been able to, but I feel like
we should shoot some over the summer.
We should, and like, just like, filmmaking itself has so many different like mediums. You can film on so many different cameras. It's just like so expansive, and so I'm like, I gotta revisit that.
Recently, I shot 16mm film.
Okay.
And that was a really interesting process, too. It's really expensive to shoot motion picture film, as you know.
Yeah, how does 16mm compare to, like, what you'd go to the movie theater and see?
I mean, well, 16mm is a very... Not a tiny format. It's double the size of Super 8, right? Okay. But it's half of 35mm. And most sort of productions are shot in 35. 35 is kind of like standard.
Okay.
16 is like half of that. So I'd say it has more grain and less definition, like the but more character.
Width of the film you're talking?
Or, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
And I just think that it's... My gripe with Super 8 is the lack of manual control. The fact that you can just like pull a trigger and it just films automatically is like, it's fun. It has its place in time.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to be able to have more control to craft the image, and shape the light, as I'm filming. And that's why it was so sort of revolutionary to be able to shoot on it. The resource library got a 16mm camera and a bunch of film. And I decided to shoot some of that film and then process it myself, because it's way cheaper to do that. I'm not paying for any of that, actually. Right.
You're paying it for my way of being a student.
Yeah, exactly. So I might as well take advantage of that, right?
Exactly.
But what I would otherwise have to do is send it to a lab for about $50 for them to, like, process and scan it. But thankfully, we have a darkroom here, and so I can at least do that with the black and white film. And that also is, like, I think built upon my experience with film photography. Starting from a still medium into motion has been really, really helpful because it kind of gives you a solid base where you're not moving too fast, and it's not nearly as expensive to shoot. And a lot of those skills transferred for me.
Well, I always just love hearing about other films and filmmakers that other people love. So, yeah, talk about some filmmakers' work that's top of mind for you now, or work that is just, like, you've held close to the chest. Like, you know, I know you mentioned Alfonso Cuarón, and then another filmmaker who I looked up.
We're asset talk.
Okay, I'm butchering. I'm
sorry. No, you're good. You're good. It's a long, complicated name. It took me a while to learn how to pronounce it.
You said that, like, he was a Thai director, right?
So yeah.
And I don't know if you also talked about Loving Wong Kar Wai with me, or if I just... Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, talk about some of those people, like, and why do you gravitate towards them? There's, like, you mentioned, like, some of those filmmakers allowed you to find the, like, slow, meditative cinema that really resonates with you. So, expand on that.
For sure. Cuarón, really, my entry into his work was Roma. That was the first film I ever watched that he directed and shot. I think there, the sort of resonance for me really was about the sort of pacing of the film. It was sort of my, I guess, my first introduction to slow cinema. And I don't even know if I would call Roma slow cinema. It has elements, it borrows elements from slow cinema, as so far as pacing goes, mm-hmm. but it fluctuates. Right. It goes between moments of high intensity and low intensity.
Right.
And it really doesn't gloss over the more mundane details, which I think is what slow cinema really is about,
mm-hmm.
is about letting the camera linger, letting time pass by for the audience to experience with the characters that we're watching. That was a very eye-opening experience for me because I really hadn't encountered much work like that. A lot of sort of more commercial cinema is driven by maximizing the sort of seconds on the screen. You have to jam-pack the story with all this information, and they're only sort of concerned with holding the attention of the audience. But I love the idea of flipping that on its head and sort of allowing the audience to breathe, to really take in what's happening, even if nothing is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least on the surface, it doesn't seem like it, but there really is a lot going on. So long takes really are a trademark of that film. I know that Cuarón was very influenced by his collaborations with Emmanuel Lubezki, who did the cinematography for Children of Men.
I haven't watched, but I'll add it to my list.
Yeah, and he's done a bunch of work with other directors like Alejandro González Iñárritu on like Birdman. He's worked with like Terrence Malick on Tree of Life. But just sort of letting the camera linger is something that I've sort of thought about a lot. And I was actually able to put that into practice with Ask the Birds, the film that Nicole directed and is actually screening later today.
So excited.
And
you're going to be on a panel.
which I didn't know about until more recently. I was like, okay, I guess this is happening now. For a film that I made more than a year ago and I've very much sort of moved on from, but
no,
whatever.
Don't say that. It's amazing. I love that film. Like, these are like, these films are like your foundation. And I like,
true.
You're so prolific and it's so easy to like, being so young, I would consider you prolific and I feel like it would be so easy for you to be like, yeah, it's in the past. Yeah, I did that a year ago. I have like four more films under my belt. But I'm like, from my perspective, I'm like, oh, that's like, you're gonna grow so much and
yeah.
like imagine like if that's where you're starting, imagine where you're gonna go. But yeah, continue.
And just that sort of what our guiding philosophy in approaching that film was really thinking through the idea of meditation. It is narratively a theme in the film, but then to approach the cinematography with a similar idea in mind. We really wanted to go back to the basics.
Was any of that shot on film?
No.
All digital. Okay. Because it feels like it was. Like, how did you achieve that?
I think just by the nature of the way that color grading happens.
Specific lenses, you would say?
No. The gear we were using on that was pretty standard. We used a Canon C100, which is a sort of older cinema camera. And Rokinon lenses, which I think you can pick up a whole set for like under $2,000, which is pretty amazing.
That's good.
So nothing crazy. The gear that we used on Moving Room was significantly different. We used an FX6, which is like miles apart, and then we used DZO Vespid lenses, which is like, yeah. It's a world apart.
So excited to see it.
But coming back to Ask the Birds and sort of thinking through like pacing and stuff, I would say that Roma definitely influenced Ask the Birds.
We decided not to move the camera the entire duration of the film, to really focus on composition, let the composition do the work. So another filmmaker that really comes to mind for that is Yasujiro Ozu, who,
yes,
yeah, who would do that with his films, not move the camera at all.
When I was a sophomore, I think, for one of a final project I did, I did a video essay on like stasis, I guess, in film, and the idea of like the camera not moving. So I looked at Tokyo Story, I looked at Stranger Than Paradise, like, I don't know, that sticks with me as well. So I'm glad you brought that up. But something else, like tying Ask the Birds back to Roma, is sound, and like how the sound environment is really well depicted. It's like, of course it's called Ask the Birds, you hear a lot of birds, but then like nature is so well picked up. So like, good job to whoever is doing sound for that.
Yeah, that was all Nicole, with maybe some help from me. But yeah, I think that was definitely guiding our process with that, to focus mostly on sound design without score for the film. Nicole definitely was thinking about not using any sort of music on the soundtrack, and that it would pretty much be just diegetic sound.
You know what? I couldn't even tell.
And that's what it shows with Roma. You're so right.
I couldn't even tell, like, because all of the, whether or not it was diegetic, non-diegetic sound is so musical. So, like, that's so smart. Like, I'm going to steal that idea. I'm literally going to steal that idea. I guess the last thing I want to ask you before I ask you to shout out any work you're working on upcoming, things you want to get out there, is a question I ask everyone. When people think of Gianni Was Productions, what do you want them to think? Like, what do you want them to take away from it? Say someone who's never seen your work before, maybe someone who doesn't even really view movies in a really intellectual way, has a surface level attachment to them. What would stick with you if they were to take something away from it? What would that be? What would you want that to be?
I think I would want people to take away what I take away very often from films that really impact me. I hope that it sort of changes their perception of the world and life in some capacity, as I know that I've very much been impacted by films, and kind of realizing the freeing possibility that art brings us, that there really are no rules. You can do whatever the fuck you want. That's super exciting. But also just to like notice a different way of looking at the world, right? It's like, that's what film is all about, is kind of telling stories to broaden our perspectives,
right?
Because we're not all living the same lives. And that's a beautiful thing. To be able to get an insight into the way that other people are perceiving the world. There's this quote from Yi, a film by Taiwanese director Edward Yang, that really sticks with me. I don't remember what exactly the quote is, but it's something along the lines of, movies let us live. Like, since movies were invented, now humans live, I don't know, maybe 100 more lives than we used to, which I think is a beautiful, beautiful sentiment.
That's so amazing. Perfect way to wrap that up. What do you want people to like see of yours? Like, you could plug your website, your Instagram, and you mentioned you're working on a photography book.
Mm-hmm.
How can people support you in that?
Yeah. I think the greatest way anyone can support me is to look at my work, engage with it, talk to me about it. That's really the most I could ask for. My website is gianniwasp.com. My Instagram handle is gianni13wasp. And the two projects that are on my horizon for release coming up soon are Moving Room, a personal semi-autobiographical short film, and Meditations on Coming Home, a photography book, and potentially exhibition.
Yes.
Yeah, which that I'm working on that as well.
Amazing.
But yeah, those are what's on the horizon for me.
And God willing, the film you're going to DP for me.
Yeah, I'm super excited for that. Right. What do we even call it? After Work?
I'm calling it After Work now, but I know that you will probably figure out a better title. Like, and I just know it, so I'm not even going to even say that.